So let's turn to Esther chapter 5. If you have a Bible with you, if you don't, there's no problem, it'll be on the screen. Esther chapter 5. We're going to read all of the chapter. This is our fifth sermon in the series of Esther. Esther chapter 5, from the opening verse. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gates, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she has prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her, together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. God's word. Well, I'm sure you all know what it's like to have an important date looming in front of you. Maybe for some, it was the first day back at school. Whether you were a pupil or a parent or a teacher, maybe this past week that was a date that perhaps filled you with dread and anxiety. Or maybe for some, we can think of an appointment, a doctor's appointment perhaps, and as it drew near, it just filled us with a sense of worry and concern. Or maybe the date of some test or some exam, a specific day in the calendar, and there's a shadow hanging over it, as it were. I think some ministers of the gospel, most ministers of the gospel, would say the Lord's Day is a little bit like that, a day that's filled with significance and importance. We all have days that we have like that, days in our diaries and our calendars, and they are just more important, more significant than usual. You go to sleep the night before and it's the last thing you're thinking about. And you wake up in the morning and it's the first thing you think about. It all comes flooding into your minds. As we turn to Esther chapter 5, That day, that kind of day, has arrived for Esther. But it's a day far more fearful than any of us are likely to face. It's a day when she's going to come before the king. Now, you remember what's happened before now, don't you? Esther, she is a Jewish orphan, and she's living in the land of Persia. She's been taken quite a few years ago now, maybe 5-7 years ago before this. She's been taken by the palace guards to enter a beauty contest for the king, King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes. He needed a new queen because he'd just got rid of his old one. And in the providence of God, Esther is selected by the king to become queen. And it's an amazing rise to prominence for this young girl. And all the while, she has hid her Jewishness. She's hid the fact that she belongs to the people of God, and she hasn't let anyone know about her Jewish cousin Mordecai, who had raised her as his own daughter. Mordecai, he's deeply concerned about Esther's welfare. He hangs around the palace gate day after day. In the process, he overhears an assassination plot against the king. He dutifully reports it up the chain of command. The king is kept safe. And we're then introduced to the villain of the story, a man named Haman, who is promoted to the role of prime minister. He's a man filled with his self-importance, with an inflated sense of ego. He is puffed up, Haman. Especially so when the king orders everyone to bow down before Haman. But he becomes livid when Mordecai refuses to bow down in front of him. Now, there's bad blood between those two men, Haman and Mordecai, that goes back generation and generation. And Mordecai refuses to bow. Haman gets mad. He persuades the king to announce a new law that not just Mordecai, but all the Jews in the kingdom, that they should be executed. Just get rid of them. This is council culture at its finest. Just get rid of them. They don't agree with us. Let's get rid of them. And the law is announced. The date is set. And you can imagine the devastation that follows. Mordecai is desperately upset. He's able to get the attention of Queen Esther. He fills her in on all the details and pleads with her to stand in the gap, to speak up on behalf of the Jews. And eventually, at the end of chapter 4, we left off with Esther bravely deciding to approach the king and plead their case. The thing is, everyone knew to approach the king without an invitation, that meant certain death. You did not just dander in to the presence of King Ahasuerus without an invite. As well, Esther, we're told, she hasn't spoken to him in 30 days. It's quite clear she's fallen out of favor somewhat. Not to mention that this law is not up for debate. It's not been put out for consultation. This is a law of the Medes and Persians. It was an irreversible decree. So it's fair to say, isn't it? Esther wakes up on this morning, the day she's going before the king, and things are not looking good at the start of chapter 5. Things are not looking good. But what follows in chapter 5 is really quite incredible. I want to highlight three themes that emerge from this chapter. Because here in these verses, we can learn something about wisdom, and we can learn something about pride, and then there's also a word of encouragement for us. So we're going to look at Esther's wisdom, Haman's pride, and then our encouragement. So let's look firstly at Esther's wisdom. Esther's wisdom. The chapter begins with the words, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace." Now, any thinking person, when they're reading that, should be asking themselves, well, third day of what? What's that talking about? Well, for that, we have to go back to the end of chapter 4. And if you have a Bible in front of you, look back with me to chapter 4, verse 16, where we're told, before she even set foot in front of the king, chapter 4, verse 16, Esther said to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews found in Susa, hold a fast on my behalf, do not eat or drink for 3 days. Night or day, I and my young woman will fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So you see, before she took any action, before she set foot in the palace in front of the king, she and the entire Jewish community fasted. They set aside 3 days, a period of self-humbling, seeking God's face. That's what this fasting is. It's not a quick fire way to lose weight. This was a sign of self-humbling, seeking God's face for help. In other words, you could say Esther and all the people of God, they spent 3 days seeking God's face in the midst of this crisis. And it's on the third day of this fasting and prayer period that Esther comes before the king. And immediately we're reminded of the importance, the priority that prayer should have in our lives, friends, aren't we? I mean, is there not for all of us this tendency, when there's a great need in our lives, to just rush in and do something about it? We have this tendency to just quickly make a decision, to take action. And this would seem to be one of those moments for Esther, doesn't it? It's a very urgent situation. But she doesn't rush instantly into the task. She has a great work to do, yes. But she knows that she has a greater work to do on her knees beforehand. Let's fast, she says. Let's pray, and then I'll go to the king. Before anything was done, they prayed. Before Esther did anything, she prayed. It's a very simple lesson. In the crises of life, before we do anything, friends, let's pray. Prayer must come first in our families, in our homes, in our church. Often there are crisis times, aren't there? And some of us, even this morning, we have a big decision in front of us, whether it's regarding job or income or home or relationships. Do you see, prayer must come first. There's a white space in our Bibles between chapter 4 and chapter 5. And that white space symbolizes a whole period of prayer in the life of Esther and her fellow believers. Maybe this is one of those white space times in your life, a time for seeking God's face. Don't think that prayer is a last resort, the last option. Far from it. It should be first resort. And prayer does something. We see that so clearly here. We see it in a number of ways. Prayer does something for Esther and her situation. For one thing, think of the colossal task that's in front of her. The odds stacked against her. Her life hanging in the balance. But she comes and she stands before the king. She's bold. She's courageous. She's brave. Where's this courage come from? I mean, Esther was not so brave in chapter 4. Surely this courage has come from prayer. Those 3 days seeking God's face, have they not changed Esther? Prayer often does that. It changes us more than it changes anything else. Prayer has changed Esther and it's filled her with a sense of courage. Maybe you need courage this morning. Maybe there's a tremendous task in front of you, a decision to make, difficult steps to take. Courage is found on your knees before the Lord. Look at Esther. That's not all that prayer does for her. Look at verse 2. When the king saw her, she won favor in his sight. He held out to her the golden scepter. Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Remember, she hasn't been called in 30 days. She's out of favor. She's forgotten, really. Unsummoned, she appears before this king. He could have had her killed for such an act. And yet, she instantly wins his favor. He's pleased with her. It's a wonderful answer to prayer, isn't it? And Esther is seeing that truly the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. He's extremely tender towards her, very generous. Verse 3, he said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request?" He doesn't even know what it is. "It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom." Now, he doesn't literally mean that. Most commentators say that this was a manner of speaking. It's hyperbole. It's exaggeration. But he's still being very kind, very polite, very, very generous even. And this is all in answer to the prayer of Esther and the people of God. The prayer of the people of God had power to change the heart of the king. The praying of the people of God had power to change the heart of the king. Friends, God can handle anyone in your life. He can handle anyone in your life. Your boss, your colleague, your neighbor, your husband, your wife, your children. Their hearts are but a channel of water in the hand of the Lord. Answer to prayer. And then we see the wisdom of Esther. Wisdom that has certainly come through prayer as well. We see her, verse 1, she takes time to put on her royal robes. In other words, she's dressing to impress here. She doesn't go before the king distraught in her pajamas and slippers. She puts on her royal best. Verse 2, even though she's breaking the law, but by appearing before the king, she follows all the protocol, all the procedures. The scepter's lowered and she touches the tip. She's respectfully acknowledging her position and his position. When he's kind and generous, openly invites her to say what you want, Esther. She doesn't just blurt out her request. She has a wise plan. Verse 4. If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared. Now notice she has it all prepared. A feast I have prepared. In other words, she's not winging it here. She's got this all thought out. The banquet is already set. And just by the way, I don't think this is of any theological significance, but how difficult must it have been for Esther to prepare a feast at the same time as fasting for 3 days? It's like doing Christmas dinner and not being allowed to eat it. That's completely by the by. I don't think there's anything to be taken from that. But do you see how wise she is? If she had simply started begging for the life of her people, I don't think anything would have been accomplished. But she's wise, she is shrewd, she knows the way through a man's heart is through his stomach. Verse 6, they've had their feast, a party of three, Haman's there, they're having their coffee and their after-eats, they just finished it, and the king then asks her, "Well, what's troubling you, Esther? Share with us." And again, she says, no, come tomorrow, I'll have another feast. Tomorrow I'll spill the beans. I'll tell everything. For some reason, as we'll learn, God's timing requires one more day. She's very wise. She's got it all thought out. And she is maneuvering the king into a position where he's almost compelled to do what she wants. and her wisdom, surely it's come through prayer. Through prayer. How many times have we heard James 1, verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Do you need wisdom this morning? Ask God for wisdom. And what need there is today for wise Christians. As believers, we so often look the need for practical common sense, for this kind of wisdom. And yet this is one of the things that stands out in this chapter, Esther's wisdom. So Esther's wisdom, that's the first thing. We'll move a bit quicker now. We want to think secondly about Haman's pride. Haman's pride. We meet him in verse 9, and you could say he's on cloud 9, Haman. Things could not be better as far as he's concerned. He's just been to the palace for dinner with the king and queen, and he's got a booking for the same time tomorrow. And no wonder verse 9 describes him, joyful and glad of heart. He's skipping home, really. He's thinking, I am the man. I am the man. I'm the king and queen's favorite person. He leaves with a spring in his step. Everyone's bowing to him, left, right, and center as he goes home. Everyone, that is, until he turns a corner, and there's Mordecai. And Mordecai doesn't rise. Mordecai doesn't bow. Mordecai doesn't tremble. And Haman is furious. He just heads straight home. He sends for his wife and his friends. And then you can see verses 11 and 12. This is really crazy, verse 11 and 12. How he boasts about all he has, his riches, his sons, his promotions, his dinner invitations to the palace. He thinks he's the center of the universe. It's like one of those round-robin Christmas cards, but on steroids here, verse 11. He is going way over the top. Who talks like this? But still, he can't get rid of the fact that Mordecai refuses to bow, and it just infuriates him. And his wife has had enough. She says, look, do something about it. Verse 14, just get rid of Mordecai now. Don't wait to the execution date. Get rid of him now. The plan pleases Haman, of course. He's such an evil maniac. He orders a gallows to be built, a wooden structure upon which Mordecai would be publicly hung. 50 cubits high, we're told. That's about 75 feet. That's about four times the height of a fully grown giraffe. Four giraffes on top of each other. This is massive, massive scale. It's a high enough structure so that everyone would see Mordecai being killed. And it's all boosting Haman's ego. His whole world revolved around his ego, and his ego is very fragile, isn't it? When he's invited to these banquets, he just puffs up with importance. But when he's ignored by Mordecai, he is infuriated. He is a proud, proud man. And if there's one thing the Bible is clear about, it's that God hates pride. God hates pride. Proverbs 16, verse 5. Everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured he will not go unpunished. Or 1 Peter 5, verse 5. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And surely the words of Proverbs 16, verse 18 couldn't be any more appropriate for a man. Proverbs 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. We're going to see, God willing, in due course, Haman's destruction and how these very gallows would be instrumental in his downfall. But we need to take heed from this man, because I think inside all of us, there's a little Haman. I think inside all of us, there's a little Haman. Someone who loves to see their status and reputation inflated. Someone tempted to get puffed up within themselves. We need to take heed, friends. God opposes the proud. And consider how different our Savior is to Haman here. Jesus said, "Learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly of heart." No pride in Jesus. He humbled himself, Paul says, and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. He made himself of no reputation. Though he was rich, yet for our sake he became poor. The polar opposite of Haman. So let's learn a thing or two from Haman's pride. Haman's pride. So Esther's wisdom, Haman's pride. Thirdly, our encouragement. Our encouragement. Throughout this book of Esther, we've been considering the invisible hand of the sovereign Lord, the God of Esther, who is never mentioned, but his fingerprints are everywhere. I titled this sermon, Approaching the King, because really that's what it's all about. Esther making her approach to King Ahasuerus. But Ahasuerus isn't the only king in these verses. He isn't the only king we should be thinking of. Because over and above him, there's another king. A bigger king. A better king. And unlike Esther, we don't have anything to fear in approaching our king. Just think, Esther woke up that day. She was risking everything to come before a cruel, unstable man. Her knees trembling, her heart wondering, would she survive? Would he lower his scepter to her? Or would he have her killed? It's not like that when we approach our king. Esther came uninvited. She had to try and do everything to maneuver the king into offering her something. It's not like that when we come to our king. Friends, you and I are coming before a loving Father in heaven, a God of grace and mercy. And today and every day, our King is holding out to us his royal scepter, as it were. And he says, you can come, and you can come today, and you can come any time, as long as you want, however you want. I will always allow you, because the rod of my wrath, it fell already. It fell on my son. It's not going to fall on you. You can come. We are warmly, lovingly invited. And we have access into the very throne room of heaven. A blood-bought access through the work of Jesus. You could say our King has an open-door policy. Come, he says. And in fact, as Esther was inviting her king to a feast, our king, he's invited us to the feast. He's invited us to the wedding feast of the Lamb, a banquet already prepared. Do you see? Our king, our better king, and we have every encouragement to come before him in prayer. What a privilege. What a privilege to come before our Father in heaven, a King who delights in seeing us coming, who delights in hearing our voices through Christ. So let me ask you, as I ask myself, what are you doing with that privilege? What are you doing with that privilege? What are you doing with this blood-bought access? The writer to the Hebrews says, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need."